Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore in the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Ann Stickney, one of several lore aficionados over on the Blizzard Watch staff, and I've got both of my marvelous co-hosts with me today. First up, he knows a lot about warriors, he knows a lot about lore. That would be Matt Rossi. Hey Rossi, how's it going?
I'm doing okay.
How are you doing after that D&D session yesterday? Because that was wild.
I'm kind of in that post-DMing mindset where I feel like I'm slow. Which is why I'm talking like this. I just realized they even sound like I'm slow.
It's just, okay.
Everything's kind of...
By the end of the show here, you're going to be really involved in whatever the heck we're talking about today, which is, you know, probably going to be more emails and stuff here. But anyway, I should go ahead and introduce our other co-host. That would be Joe Perez. Hey, Joe, how's it going?
It's going great. I have a D20 this size on my head. So today is a great day.
What is that made out of? Because I saw the picture on Twitter and it looked like it was made out of clay.
It's plastic. So my friend actually has several 3D printers. And so like occasionally I'll have like some of my custom sculpts and stuff printed by him. And
cool.
So today he dropped this off it was just like not expected. It's huge. It's super light. I'm going to paint it bright fire engine red and give it gold numbers because I can. And then I'm going to break it out when I DM and scare the heck out of my players because why not?
It's super funny because the dice set that I have that my sister gave me is bright fire engine red with gold letters. Anyway.
Heck yeah.
She basically had like a couple of sets to pick from and it was either that or pink. And I was like, no, I like red. I want red. So
the red ones go faster.
The red ones, yeah, they go faster. Vroom, vroom. Anyway, so this week we are going to be diving back into the mailbag because we haven't even scratched the surface on the emails, and I think we've probably gotten more emails while we've been doing the answer the emails, so we may have to dip back into that and make our list here even longer. If you guys do have an email for the show, you can send that to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Make sure you put Lore Watch in the subject line so we know it's intended for this show. Keep in mind, too, that we are always looking for questions for the Blizzard Watch podcast as well. And you guys can throw like quick lore questions over there, too. We don't care. We prefer the non-lore stuff, but there's not a lot of news to talk about right now, so we'll take just about anything.
And I would say, to add to that, make sure you put them in there and don't just try to throw them at us individually because sometimes we will miss things.
Yeah, make sure you send it to the email or the other place that you can throw it if you're looking to throw it somewhere. Blizzard Watch does have a Discord available and there is a Q&A podcast questions channel on the Discord. So if you join the Discord, you can go ahead and submit a question there. Again, just make sure that you let us know with the question where that's intended for, whether it's intended for the Q, whether it's intended for the Blizzard Watch podcast, or whether it's intended for this one, just so we have a general idea of where we're supposed to go with that question. Anyway, regardless, let's go ahead and start with these emails because we got quite a lot of them. So this one is from Leoden, who's a protection ret paladin on Veclanesh, who says, "Hey, lore masters, Leoden again. Something that came to mind while looking through old quests and while on transmog runs, when the Death Knights tried to bring Fordring back, the light prevented him from being taken. This makes me question when the Shadowlands was broken, because why would the light prevent the Death Knights from saving him from the Maw? Is this what the old god quote of the light making a deal with the enemy of all was? Just one more thing to bounce off you guys. Love the show. Leoden." What do you guys think about that? Particularly the fact that Fordring was prevented from going anywhere. The Naru jumped in and said, no, he's not going anywhere.
Well, the Naru didn't.
Okay, the light did. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Well, I mean, sometimes I get the two confused.
Sometimes they get the two of them confused. I think that's where we had problems with Zira.
Mm-hmm.
You and I were talking on the Blizzard Watch podcast this week, and you made the point that we know Kael'thas went to where he was supposed to go. So
yeah, he did, because we're going to run into him there.
Yeah, things were at least functional, at
somewhat,
least up until the end of Burning Crusade, because that's when we gave Kael'thas the actual stay down this time beating, and he went to wherever he's gone. So in terms of why the light let Fordring, you know, kept Fordring from being raised from the dead, we don't know how the light works. It's quite possible the light may or may not know about the Maw being...
Maybe the light has a land of its own, which would make me wonder why it didn't take Uther, but you know.
That's not a maybe thing.
We know that it does.
The Kyrian Covenant... Their realm is absolutely light. It's light all over the place.
Well, no, that we have that quest in Northrun where the light takes what's his name too.
That's the Naru. The Naru, not the light.
Well, sorry,
you're doing it too. oh God. Just we know that they have that place where the Kyrian Covenant is, and I'm pretty sure Uther's there. There's definitely some
indication.
Yeah,
he is. We're
going to
run into him there.
Mm-hmm.
So. That therefore tells us that at the end of... Well, that's interesting because we saw Uther at the end of Wrath of the Lich King. He visits our world several times.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he died way before that. He died significantly before that, but he does visit several times. If he was stuck in the sword up until that point and then got out, I suppose that would indicate that the machinery of death was still working then. It's kind of complicated.
I have an idea.
Okay, go for it.
Do you remember we had that theory that Uther wasn't really Uther and that whole line about there must always be a Lich King was like a load of bunk because Uther was like, you could get to him at like his little temple thing and all that other stuff?
Yeah, I remember.
I remember that conversation.
All right, so... What if that wasn't Uther we were talking to, and the reason that they said there must always be a Lich King was because they wanted somebody else to put that hat on, because that was the engine thing, something.
Well,
we know that hat was important. That hat was important because you had to bust it wide open to open the way to the Shadowlands, right? So there's something really important about that hat. And whatever that was, whether it was Uther or otherwise, I feel like the reason they told us there must always be a Lich King wasn't because, oh, we don't want the Scourge to run rampant or whatever. It was because they needed something with that hat on.
I guess that's a very interesting question because there have been several points in time where that hat, like, wasn't actively being worn.
Yeah.
Like so this is something that I question about that too. Like, even before Arthas puts on the hat, there's not a body there. Nerzul's in it. Like,
yeah,
it's empty. How long was it empty with nobody wearing it?
But it was
so
sitting
why...
there at the top of Ice Crown, waiting
it's
for
never
a
left
physical
the
body.
Of... Yeah, but it never left the top of Ice Crown, even when
it was waiting for a physical body.
So then, why does it still need a physical body now? I guess that's the question for me is, what does a physical body give
it? It's not in the Frozen Throne anymore.
No, it's not.
When he cracked open the Frozen Throne, that's when his power started to leak out. He cracked open the Frozen Throne to push the sword out so that the sword could be taken to corrupt somebody. The second he did that, he started bleeding out power. There was nothing in the armor but Ner'zhul's essence. As soon as he cracked open the Frozen Throne that was holding everything together, he started losing power.
So then do we think the physical body is the battery?
I think the physical body is the replacement for the Frozen Throne.
It needs because something to inhabit, and if it's not the Frozen Throne, it needs a person.
Yeah, Ner'zhul was ripped apart.
Right.
He wasn't just tortured. He was literally torn apart. And then his essence outside of his body was bound to the Helm of Domination.
And maybe that wasn't quite enough for the helm or whatever is helming the helm. Haha, pun, sort of.
Well,
why it went looking for a champion almost immediately.
Well, he wants to be free of the Frozen Throne, which means he needs a conveyance. He needs a body. But the Frozen Throne itself was the only thing sustaining him, because as soon as he pierced it with the sword, as soon as he pushed the sword through and out into the world, he started leaking power. That's how he started losing control of the Forsaken. That's how they all got free.
Sure, but so then the question at that point for that still remains, who would want that somebody to still be wearing that helm? Because at that point, Ner'zhul's been shredded again, essentially, right? Like, we know he's part of it still, but like, the whole Arthas book, he's not in control
anymore. Is he part of it? We see him again, but we don't see him in the helm. We see him in the rune blades.
Yeah.
It's when the remains of Frostmourne are turned into... Yeah, it's the remains of Frostmourne. That's where we see him. When you as a Death Knight, you go in and you see Arthas and you see Ner'zhul inside the remains of the Deathblades, not in the helm.
Well, I was talking about before that.
But that's the thing. We may be making an assumption that is not relevant. The helm may not have contained Ner'zhul at all after it got put on Bolvar's head. It may not have contained Arthas.
Maybe Ner'zhul was actually in the sword, and the sword was physically trying to escape.
And the reason that someone needs to be wearing the helm is because the same reason that destroying the helm rips open the boundary to the Shadowland. Without an anchor, you know, without the anchor of the Frozen Throne, the armor began leaking power. Ner'zhul was dying. The helmet was consuming him. Maybe he escaped, and that's why it needed to be on somebody else. Because without that, it's got nobody to consume, and it'll rip open.
So then, but then that begs the question of why would the Legion do that way back when?
Why did we assume that the Legion did it? We don't know that the Legion made that thing. That we were told they did, but we don't know that that's true.
I don't think they did. I think it's much like everything else. It's sort of like, I don't think ANR made the Emerald Dream. I think ANR opened a gateway to it. Well, I'm wondering, I don't think the Legion made the helm. I think they gained access to it.
Yeah, but what would their reason be for maintaining it, though?
Why do they maintain the Warglit? There's multiple artifacts that the Legion got hold of and used that they didn't create, and they maintain them because they're powerful. There's one particular Death Knight artifact, which are the Warblades that a champion used against Sargeras. He fought Sargeras with these things. That's why they kept them. They didn't keep them, you know. The Legion doesn't know everything the helmet can do in this assumption. And again, it's just an assumption. But if the Legion didn't know what the helmet was for, it just knew that using the helmet, you could create a powerful servant that would help them get around the problem they were having conquering Azeroth. They were trying an end run. The whole deal with the Legion was a backdoor. They weren't pulling it off just going in straight attacking. They tried that back in the day with the War of the Ancients. It didn't work. They tried that with Sargeras, trying to get in through the back door with Medivh and the Horde, and it didn't work. Okay, what if we try this? And we stole this powerful artifact from somewhere. The Nathrezim might have brought it to them. Who knows? And they tried it again. And it's like, we've all this stuff that we don't know. And we have to admit that we don't know it.
We've already contemplated the idea of the Nathrezim actually being from the Shadowlands.
Yeah.
Or yeah, the Necrolords or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's like two places that the Nathrezim look like they'd fit. But I mean, all of this, I mean, you know, why would they maintain it? Because it allows them to do something powerful than that they couldn't do on their own. They didn't seem to know that? Because they're arrogant jackholes. If you look at the people who supposedly use this helmet, who is it? It's Kil'jaeden. Kil'jaeden also just, you know, went to Illidan Stormrage at one point and said, I'm not going to kill you. I just want you to destroy the Lich King for me. How come he couldn't just destroy the Lich King himself? If he made that helmet and knew everything it could do, why was he suddenly incapable of just killing the Lich King by himself? Why did he need
Illidan? That's true. I want to let Joe talk just, here for a minute, though.
So, I mean, part of my stuff with this is, like, there's a lot of contradiction here as far as, like, anything revolving around the Helm of Domination. And everything we're saying is just, I mean, of course, most of what we say is speculation, but like going back to Arthas.
I just picture Steve DeNuser is sitting here listening to this, cackling. Okay, anyway, go for it.
But in the Arthas book, right, and this is something that we talked about a little bit, but we haven't really talked about since we really started talking about the Helm of Domination again. In that book, it states that the Helm of Domination was created in the Forge of Domination, which we are going to be visiting again, apparently, in the Shadowlands, by the demons of the Burning Legion. So our theory of maybe it was the Nathrezim might hold water there just based on that alone. But in the book, it says specifically for containing the spirit of Ner'zhul and granting him his Lich King powers. So I don't know if Ner'zhul started in those blades. I think he might have actually started in the helm and found his way.
No. I didn't say he started in the blades. I said he was in the blades when Bolvar had the helmet on.
Sure.
I said he wasn't in the helmet anymore.
Now,
but the fact is, the books also contradicted things that were said in Wrath of the Lich King after it came out.
And are so, we dealing with another unreliable narrator, basically?
Yeah. The thing is that who in the book is telling you that it was made specifically to contain the power of the Lich King, to give those powers to Ner'zhul? Who says that? Is this something Ner'zhul just knows? Is this something that Kil'jaeden has said to Ner'zhul? Where does that information come from?
The where I'm going with this, though, is and this is where I think that the helm is obviously it's very important. We know that it's important, but what if it was needed to be worn and needed to remain and needed to have somebody using it because it was channeling death? It was channeling souls. And when it broke, whatever it was contained, whatever it was holding, whatever it was dominating, that power was released. And if it is a soulbound item that was for whatever reason, or you know, if the assumption that I make that it is linked to the jailer in any way, that's what allowed that to be ripped open, was not necessarily it being a key to the realms, but literally just the unleashing of all that power flooding into the maw at that exact point. Because Torghast is what appears above Ice Crown, not anywhere else. Torghast. It is the maw. It is right where all this stuff has been funneling. And we make the assumption that it's, you know, or people have made the assumption that, well, it's just because the engine's broken. What if it's not? What if it's just the unleashing of all that power that the Lich King Helm has been containing, controlling, and siphoning for however long it's existed? That's why that ripped open that portal in reality between those two specific points. Now, to go back to the root of the question that we kind of strayed a little bit from, and I just want to address the question real quick.
It's okay.
Because I think this is relevant here. This is why I'm bringing it back. Things can intervene before the engine of death sort of kicks in. And we know that because as player characters, we've existed somewhat outside of that cycle by being led back by spirit healers from the Shadowlands to the Prime Material Plane or whatever, to Azeroth proper. The light, nothing says it can't do the exact same thing. We know that there are beings that can intervene, that we know that there are creatures that can intervene before you go anywhere. We've seen it with the spirits of the ancients. We've seen it with Death Knights. We've seen it with the undead. We've seen it with the Naru. We've seen it with a whole slew of creatures and beings throughout the entire universe of Warcraft. So it maybe not that the light is preventing the DKs from bringing him, you know, back so much as the light already made a claim to him and they can intervene because they just can't. They can choose to, it can choose to act when it wants to. And also, this is where it's choosing to act.
One thing, though, that we do also have to do if we're addressing that, at no point do you actually get to even try to raise Tyrion.
Mm-hmm. You're just blocked from getting access
to him.
No,
the light stops you before you get that far.
Yeah, so it's not like they would have to be intervening to save Tyrion. It could just be intervening. They're just intervening to keep you from befouling the place any more than you already have. Because this is the place where the light... And this is weird because if you think about it, the reason that the light is there underneath that place is because it's the place where so many people were laid to rest. What?
Do you think it's another like?
But think about that. Think of, the reason that the light is there is because so many people died there, and this is where they were laid to rest in its hallowed ground.
Do you think it's anything similar to like the Mogu when they have that giant soul engine that just like essentially creates new bodies for souls?
No, I think it's more along the lines of the opposite. Do you remember when you go to, again, we're going back to Wrath, you go to the room with Bron Jam.
Yeah, you're talking about the Forge of Souls.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the room above it, which is absolutely swelling with energy.
Yeah.
Where is that energy coming from? Is it just the souls of the departed? And if the souls of the departed created that kind of energy, but when you have the souls of the departed in Light's Hope create the light, why is that happening? Is one place pulling the souls through and the other place channeling them somewhere else? Where else are they being channeled to? How did this get the light's attention? Why is the light paying attention? And why is the light so powerful there that Arthas himself couldn't walk in?
Do you think that's a function of anima? Do you think
that's an interesting question, because we know what anima does, don't we? We know there's a soul drought. We know there's a soul drought that's currently afflicting, bloody heck, I can't remember. Amberweald? It's not Amberweald. It's.
I think so. The Feyland? Yeah.
Yeah,
the Feyland one. There's a soul drought that's afflicting that place. Now, we're talking about anima, and you brought up the Mogu. One of the things we know is that there's a thing called dark animus that looks like blood. That the Mogu used to animate and change life. And
the getting from Ra.
And now we know that there's this anima that is like life force that gets channeled back into the world when things die. And we know that it lights hope, at least all those dead people's light seems to be there. Well, and it was powerful enough to stop the Death Lord cold. It was powerful enough that when we tried to get, you know, Tyrion's body, Darion Mograine got fried stepping in so that the Death Lord doesn't get hit. And it's so powerful that Arthas didn't even try to go there until after he'd sent everybody to, he wanted to lure Tyrion outside. He didn't want to try to go in after him.
So no, he was very specifically trying not to go in there.
So here's another link that I've been thinking about with this stuff too. And I'm not certain that the Legion has a monopoly on this, but we talked about soul engines a long time ago. And it's one of those things where soul engines are these wickedly powerful things that channel and harness soul energy. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be for bad. What if the light is using this place where these souls are as a sort of soul engine?
One thing here. I want to ask you this question. In Negrand, what is happening to the spirits of the orcs?
They're getting eaten by a dark Naru.
Mm-hmm.
And do they care or mind in any way?
No. Nope.
And what is what is consuming their souls doing to the Naru?
Purifying it.
And when it is fully purified or charged up, what is it going to be?
A light Naru.
And what are Naru?
That's a very good question.
Because we know that there is an ancient crystal on Argus so old that 25,000 years ago, it had been forgotten. Mm-hmm. No one there knew what it was or how it worked, and they kept it in a special shrine, and only one Draenei managed to figure out, and he wasn't a Draenei, he was an Eredar at the time, managed to figure out how to use it, and that through a vision to call the Naru to him.
It was a gift from somewhere, and that's all they knew.
And we still have no idea where that came from. Are the Naru alive? And if they are alive, are they alive in a way that isn't the same as other life forms? That seems clear.
The way that Zira talks in absolutes makes it sound like she is the light's version of the Titan Forged.
Yep.
Fulfilling her purpose, whatever that purpose may be, with very little disregard for the free will of anything that might come, like, I don't know, Illidan.
But if things pledge their souls and their power to you willingly, you don't have to force them to do it. And what is Zira doing with raising that army?
And all what do the Naru do? What do the Naru do? Ah, I've been saying this forever and ever and ever. What happens when you go to Shadrach City for the first time and you run into a doll? When you talk to him, you don't talk to him. When you go up there and you open the dialogue box, it says that you feel at peace, like everything is okay. Because that's what the Naru do. They put forth this aura of everything is okay, nothing's wrong, and they make you feel great.
But you're missing one thing that I'm trying to get across here. Is Joe is asking about soul engines.
Yeah, no, go for it.
You're asking about soul engines. What is a Naru?
It's basically a soul engine.
Yes.
I said something along those lines months ago on Twitter, and like that's kind of it. Like, that's why I said I don't think the Legion has a monopoly on them.
We know that Fel is created when light and dark, when the light and shadow utterly annihilate each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that souls can be used in soul engines to create Fel.
Because we are the culmination of light and dark.
Souls have light and dark in them. Mm-hmm. And we know that there's that ton of light in Light's Hope from dead people.
Yep.
And we know that we can see plenty of times with necromancy, we see shadowy dark magic.
Mm-hmm.
Like what Sylvanas hit Varrok with, Varrok Starfang. So the soul in itself is just like the universe. It is created of all these different forms of energy. It could very well have arcane energy in it. Plenty of things, arcane things seem to deal with souls. Arcane magic leads to warlock magic and Fel. You can switch to them. You can learn how to do arcane magic, and that knowledge will teach you how to use Fel magic. And we know that the shamanistic magic deals with ancestor spirits. Can be very easily converted to necromancy.
Yeah, I mean, look at Dark Shaman.
I was a shaman once. That's from the Lich King.
Yep.
All of this.
But I was going to say, specifically, even Dark Shaman call that out. Like, just as recently as Siege of Orgrimmar, when we're doing that, how are they shackling spirits? By using the element of spirit, by bending it to their will, by using it to power the enslavement. You're absolutely right.
And what is the reason that Azeroth, the world soul, is so powerful?
Because it has an overabundance of spirit.
And why did Azeroth not experience the same thing with its elementals as Draenor did?
Because it was consuming the spirit.
Draenor's spirit was going forth into the world. Nascent Titan world souls need spirit. They need
energy.
Consume it.
Are they soul engines?
Yeah. Or, for that matter, when they consume the element they need, the rest is still there. Does that mean that there's a symbiotic relationship where the light is freed from the spirit when it is consumed and the spirit energy goes to the world soul? Is that why, for an example, Noroshen had so much light energy at its disposal? The Titans can control and use spirit. I mean, control and use light.
And I was also wondering about that, because there's so many Titan facilities that we don't know what they're for. There's that huge engine of the makers. What was that? What is it? What was its entire purpose? It's a giant thing you can fly in and move around. We have all these things. What if they were there to make that more efficient? The consumption of whatever the soul needed.
Well, we're told
elements.
One of the things we're told when we're reading, you know, about that is that the world was created. They created a series of engines around the world to channel the power back into Azeroth. When the Well of Eternity was created,
because that whole wound was
but they never said what energy in specific they were channeling back into Azeroth,
yep.
Or how it was being generated,
or why her wound is a giant arcane font. Why is it specifically an arcane font? Is that
because the Titans
that's
are from the arcane?
But
branch.
She's not born yet.
Doesn't matter. She's a world soul. She's but still got is... Titan blood. Titan blood is arcane in nature. The Well of Eternity that we were all, you know, swimming around in, maybe drinking, that kind of thing. Yeah, that's Titan blood that we were messing around with.
So think about this, because I think Joe's got a point here. We know that the Mogu used dark anima to create living things. And we know that the Titan blood is itself also a very powerful arcane force.
Yeah.
Why are they doing it the way they're doing it? Why did they decide to shape the world the way they shaped it?
Mm-hmm.
Why did they create these giant engines to channel energy back? And at the same time, those engines often result in the creation of new Titan Forged. Because the engine of the makers is part of the construct that creates new Vrykul and new Earthen up in Ulduar. And a similar engine in the south.
I mean, the whole point was to protect the planet because it was infested with old gods. And
But who's telling us that?
Unreliable narrator.
We're learning this from people that learned it from the Titans, right? Like, that's the whole idea. Like, this
here's
is
another thing too. Here's another thing too to consider. In Legion, we one of the mounts that you can get is the priest mount.
Yeah,
and it's this bright white, like eagle, owl, cat looking thing, and it looks exactly like the owl people
From Bastion.
From Bastion.
Yep. Yeah.
In Shadowlands. There's, I'm not saying that we're being lied to. I'm saying that there's a lot to this we don't necessarily understand.
And I keep going, and I agree with you, and I keep going back to the idea that, like, we talk about the light and the void a lot, and we talk about a lot that the light sees one thing as true, the void sees everything as true. There's shades of gray in between.
I what feel like the void has been telling us, it's just hitting us with truth bombs all along.
Of course it is, because there's more than one truth, and there's, mm-hmm. you know, less than a million truths. The truth is somewhere in between. But well, what no, I'm saying is, like, no. if we're being told something from somebody's perspective, they believe it to be true. Like, even if it's the Titans delineating this information to their creations, they believe it to be true. It doesn't mean it is the entire truth.
Well, plus we're also you just made me think of Nosdormu here. And when Nosdormu is contacted by Amon-Thul.
God, as soon as you say, you just made me think of Nosdormu, I'm like, oh no, here we go.
When Nosdormu is contacted by Amon-Thul, Amon-Thul says to him, you know, to you is granted purview over time. And that means, for one thing, Amon-Thul can grant that purview. And it also means that when Amon-Thul says, that, you know, preserve the timeline, for there is one true path. One true path to what? Because there's a thing. We've been getting this idea that this is being presented as the light sees one thing and thinks it's true, and the void sees every possibility and thinks they're all true. But what if the light isn't, like, the light doesn't believe that there's only one true path and that there's only one thing that is true? The light believes there's only one desirable outcome.
Mm-hmm.
For something.
Yeah.
For whatever it is the light wants. And what is that?
The void wants nothing. Literally, the void wants nothing. The void wants void.
I'm talking about the light.
But no, I know. But that's my point. The void is operating on a balance of, we want this all to end in nothing. So any road that isn't that road is fine by us, because it will ultimately end in nothing. But they want something. And in order for something to be there, you need to go along this one prescribed path to get you to that thing, whatever it is.
And this includes reigning in the multiverse, reigning in all these alternate realities. That's what they were doing. Why?
Because only one road gets you to, you know, think of it like the old saying, you know, all roads lead to Rome.
Mm-hmm.
That's if Rome is non-existence and all roads lead there, except one of them. That one pathway, it's not any truer in the sense of true or false. It's the true path, because it gets us to where we want us to go.
Which is anywhere but Rome.
Yeah, anywhere but over there. We don't want to go over there, because that's bad. And you're talking, when you said the thing, Joe, neither of them can really actually encapsulate the idea. The light cannot encapsulate the idea that you could go on a different path
mm-hmm.
and still not go to Void Town. And the void can't either. No, no, everything will get here. No, we're not going there. But that means you're going there. No, we're not. Neither of them can actually understand that they're wrong.
Yep.
They do not see all things and think they're all true.
They are in absolutes.
They're all paths that go to where they want to go.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing, the interplay between these two forces, and then thus all the other forces. Because neither of them understand, say, Fel or the Legion. The Legion does not, you know, the Void think that the Void are like, look at the Legion and go, oh, this is going to where we want it to go. So we're fine with
that. That's why they weren't afraid of them, because no matter what, it ended in the same way they wanted it to end.
Yeah.
Not that it couldn't be destroyed by them. Just yeah.
Yeah. But the Legion saw it differently. The Legion are like, no, because when we're done, we're going to make a new thing. And that's
the Light didn't jump. Like that at all. And the Light was very much opposed.
The Light was opposed to it, because if the Legion got its way, then its one path was going to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And that's, if you look at the way Zera is with Illidan, at no point is Zera hostile to Illidan.
No.
She's just resolute.
She's very mechanical.
And Illidan himself, what Illidan says to her and what Illidan says to Velen is the same thing. Forget what they are telling us. It doesn't matter who they are. This is it's our wheel to grab. It's our direction to course. It's our path, and it can go to what we want it to be. We, you know, forget fate. Fate's what you make it. Like, let's make a road. And so you're basically, you've got one group that are trying to give you the road. They're trying to give you the not just the path, but the destination. You'll go to here and you'll go here by this road. And that's exactly what Nosdormu is given. When Amenthul talks to Nosdormu, Amenthul says, there's one true path. When you talk to Algolon's like, how could we not have conceived of this? How can you defy cosmically calculated odds? We've run the numbers. This shouldn't be happening.
But we have free will.
Yeah, and not just that.
And we don't have to follow that road. We can make our own road.
And that means when we're making our own road, we're not on any of the roads that the void is telling you should be on. The void will tell you, go this way, go that way, go this way, go that way. They'll drive you crazy with paths. None of those paths were the path you were already on, because if they were, they wouldn't be telling you anything.
We're taking a new, different road, and that's what the light finds so fascinating, because they don't know where that road goes any more than we do. And except that it doesn't go where the void is.
Yeah, exactly. And neither does the void know, because if the void knew where you were going, they wouldn't need to try and stop you. They wouldn't need to try and corrupt you. Yes, exactly.
Okay, as much as this is a fascinating discussion, and it is, and it plays right into my whole, we need to be just as wary of the Naru as we do of the old gods. We've only gotten one email, so I kind of want to move to the next one, if that's okay, unless you've got, do you want to wrap up your point here, Rossi? I'm sorry.
My point is just that when you're dealing with, like, what did the light do, why were we allowed or not allowed to do things, a lot of the times the answer is, because they didn't know we were going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Tyrion didn't get raised, not because, you know, the reason Tyrion didn't get raised was because we never got there. The light just flat out hammered, you know, would have killed your character, but it got Darian instead. But that wasn't the light preventing it from happening because of anything else. That was the light saying, get out of here. This is my place.
Yep.
Okay. Our next email is from Samantha, who says, good morning. It's not morning, it's afternoon, but we'll take that. He says, my question is, since Sylvanas broke the Lich King's crown and there is no Lich King anymore, will there be no more Death Knights created? Thank you for reading my email. Love your podcast, Samantha. That's an interesting question.
Two words. Taron Gorfiend. He created Death Knights before there was a Lich King.
Well, no, Taron didn't.
Yeah, he did. Didn't he slam the souls back in?
Well, Gul'dan.
Well, Gul'dan did, but it was before the Lich King.
Taron Gorfiend was the first one.
Yeah. Sorry, yes.
Yeah.
So you were right, but I'm just saying, Taron didn't actually do that. Yes. That was Gul'dan.
It was Gul'dan, who is our favorite evil for the sake of being evil.
And if you want, you can draw a path between Gul'dan and Ner'zhul. Ner'zhul studied Taron, because Taron Gorfiend went back to Outland, and you know, when it wasn't even Outlanded, it was still Draenor. And Taron and Ner'zhul came up with their idea to create new portals and go to some other world. So Ner'zhul studied Taron, and when Ner'zhul was stuck inside that thing, he got the idea of sticking the sword out of the Frozen Throne to create his new Death Knight, Arthas. And from there, Arthas created the Death Knights we now know.
So Death Knights are basically Gul'dan's fault.
Yes.
I mean, Death Knights are essentially just shoving a living or a soul back into a corpse.
Yeah. And you don't have to be the Lich King to do that, as
correct.
Joe has said.
Yeah,
and you don't even need it to be the same soul, because the first Death Knights were fallen orcs shoved into
human
bodies.
Yep.
They were orc necrolites, to be exact.
There's a reason why Taron looks like a man, but he was created by an orc. He's not actually a man. It's just the corpse that he's inhabiting was a man.
And one of Stormwind's best knights, one of the Brotherhood of the Horse. So, yeah, we could get all sorts of different kinds of Death Knights coming up. We don't know. But the Death Knights we're getting in patch 8.3, if you pre-ordered Shadowlands, those Death Knights are created by Bolvar.
Yeah.
He does create a whole bunch of new Death Knights.
And he spent a bunch of time in that helm, so he probably has the knowledge.
He's still, like, even though Bolvar doesn't have the hat of many powers anymore, even though he doesn't have that, he still retains the knowledge that he gleaned while he had that hat on. And the thing is like, we don't exactly know the scope of all of the knowledge that Bolvar has right now, because he gained a lot. He was just, you know, Knight of Stormwind or whatever, but when he was scorched by the Red Dragon's flames, all of a sudden he was kind of irrevocably tied to life and maybe gained a deeper understanding of how all of that worked. When he put that hat on, he was as equally irrevocably tied to death. He's suspended in between the two. and he understands both probably far better than any other creature on Azeroth.
I also like to think too, like going back to like the Arthas book and sense that there's sort of like a, I don't want to say like a natural storage of knowledge within whatever he was doing as well. So your point is absolutely correct. And I think that that gave him a deeper understanding. But then if he had access to all the knowledge of Ner'zhul and Arthas before him,
yeah,
you know, catalog that he could, you know, he's been sitting there for how many years at this point, just doing his thing. You know, he will still have that
figuring
knowledge.
Stuff yeah. out.
He still has and that knowledge. You can read your favorite book a million times, right?
And he hasn't been doing nothing up there. I mean, exactly. We've seen him do all kinds of things. We still don't have an explanation for why he was doing some of the things that he was doing. He did a lot of stuff in Legion. A lot of stuff in Legion.
Let me put it this way.
And he was still doing stuff in
Battle for Azeroth. Current.
Battle for Azeroth.
On December 7th, 2010, Cataclysm came out.
Yes.
So Bolvar was canonically Lich King at that point. So it's been roughly a decade.
Mm-hmm.
So within that 10 years, and even if you don't count it as 10 years in game, it's been at least five.
Yeah.
And more like seven or eight, I think.
Each expansion has been either a year to 2 years.
And that was, you know, we've gone through Cataclysm, Mists of Pandaria,
it's been
Warlords
about
of Draenor,
six
Legion.
Years, maybe seven in game right now.
Yeah.
So it's been almost a decade.
In that time, he has been the Lich King. For at least the first year or two, he did practically nothing. Because when you go to places like the Plague Lands in Cataclysm, they even say that the Scourge is disorganized and minor figures are reaching forth and trying to claim power for themselves.
It's like he's figuring it out.
Yeah, figures that would never have been able to do that before. Like Emhotar the Coldbringer suddenly thinks he's going to be a big shot. This is a guy whose biggest accomplishment was he managed to take over Razorfen. That guy thinks he's going to be in charge of the entire Scourge. You know, so during that year or two, Bolvar didn't do much. The Valkyr could get out and make their own little plans with Sylvanas. Other stuff was going on. Bolvar was not doing much, but in that time, he had the same ability to do what Arthas did. He accessed the helm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Arthas did.
Yeah,
when Arthas took the helm, he spent time just sitting there absorbing what he was learning and figuring out who's going to be in charge of this. Is it going to be Arthas Menethil? Is it going to be Ner'zhul? Is it going to be both of us? No, it's just going to be me. And Arthas made that decision and he pulled it off. But he had that time. And Bolvar had that time. And it's pretty obvious that neither Ner'zhul nor Arthas' souls were in there to stop him.
Yep.
No, they were already in, like, the weapon.
They were in the maw.
No, I think they were in the shards. It's pretty obvious to me they were in the shards of Frostmourne. Because when you gather them together...
Are you sure, though? Because when Sylvanas tossed herself off and everything, and that was after Frostmourne had been broken and was in pieces, she saw the spirit of Arthas Menethil in that darkness.
There's nothing to say that the soul isn't fragmented.
Oh, it could be.
That's the thing I've been thinking since the Light's Hope. Because we know that the spirits of the dead, you know, their light remained behind. That might be what we see of Uther when we go to Uther's tomb, is the light from him. But what we see of Uther when we go to Ice Crown Citadel is not the light from him.
Mm-hmm.
And may not even be Uther at all.
It might not be Uther, but it might just be a part of Uther. Because, you know, we also see Terranus.
Yeah.
And Terranus, you know, why is Terranus able to raise me from the dead? Terranus never had that power in life.
Yeah, he was just a dude. He was never a paladin or a priest.
Yeah, he was a good king, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't going around healing people or anything.
Was that Terranus?
Was it, or was it a part of Terranus, or was it Frostmourne?
Mm.
Think about that. We don't know what Frostmourne is.
Yep.
No.
We know that it was made somewhere, and we know that rune weapons, when they're broken, get stronger when you reforge them.
And what happens immediately
it
after we get
souls.
Raised?
That's what we know about it. It like hoovered souls like nobody's business.
But yeah. It also was shattered before we were raised. Yeah.
Yes, that's true. And then it got reforged as two swords.
Mm-hmm.
And then those two swords got used as an artifact. And those two swords supposedly were burned out, drawing the Sargeras power from that giant sword. What's going to happen to them next? Are they going to be forged back into one weapon?
Oh, boy.
Is that going to make them stronger again? There's like just a ton.
I feel like this is something we're going to find out in Shadowlands.
And also, I mean, like, I want to know, I think we are going to learn it, because I think we're going to learn where Frostmourne came from, because Frostmourne existed, you know,
they did before say, the Lich King, they did right? say that, and when they were talking about Torghast, they said one of the things that we will be exploring when we're in Torghast is the origins of the Helm of the the Helm of Domination and Frostmourne. So we're going to be finding out more information about that in Shadowlands for sure.
I'm wondering if we are actually going to go to the Forge of Domination and meet the blacksmith.
Yeah, because who's the blacksmith who came up with that idea, and who gave him the blueprints?
Because again, like, going back to the Helm of Domination, but like, everything up to this point tells us, and again, unreliable narrators, all that aside, like, grain of salt, that both items were created in the Forge of Domination. Heck of a place that you're building that stuff by name alone. And we're gonna visit there. We're gonna build our own domination armor using runes gathered from Torghast. Like, this is stuff that they have said in interviews and panels since BlizzCon. Like, there is going to be our own creation of this in the Forge of Domination. We're going to the place where these things were made.
I'm a little bit sketched out by that whole idea, but
I'm sketched out that we're going
to
be
excited. I'm kind of excited to see what exactly is going to happen when we're there.
I mean, I'm sketched out by soul binding still, because we're tying our souls to something else to get power. What are they getting out of the deal from us? Because I don't think it's a one way street.
Okay, we're going to go ahead and go to the next email. Samantha, anyway, answer to your question. Yeah, there's still going to be Death Knights, and there will still be Death Knights created. There are ways to do that. Next email is from Sophie, who's a Frost Death Knight from Zangarmarsh, NA. And you know what? It seems like we're just, like, running into a pile of Death Knight stuff here, because now we've got Death Knights asking questions. Sophie says, hey guys, ever since the BlizzCon cinematic, I've been trying to figure out exactly how and when Sylvanas' benefactor gave her the powers she used against both Saurfang and Bolvar. While leveling in Stormheim and after she makes her mysterious deal with Helya, we see an in-game cinematic between her and Greymane. In this fight, she doesn't seem to use the swirly purple powers she's been using since the start of Battle for Azeroth, and in fact she loses to Greymane, who manages to take and destroy the lantern, binding Ire? Is that how we pronounce it?
Ire.
Okay. Yep. Anyway, I don't see why she wouldn't have killed Greymane at this point if she had these powers that she used to defeat Bolvar. Why would she not get quote-unquote souped up until after this point? What happened between Legion and Battle for Azeroth that led to her receiving these powers? Thanks as always, Sophie. That's a very good question.
I honestly think that you see some of that in that fight, right? Like, and to go back... The crux of the thing,
bit,
I think,
a little
she
bit.
Bams.
Yeah.
Like, but here's the thing. Just because you have that power doesn't mean you instantly know how to use it. And we just talked about that with Arthas and the Lich King and that stuff. You know, she...
Yeah,
because
Bolvar had to take his time to learn how to do Lich King stuff.
Yeah, and she's casting a black arrow here, which is the first time, I think, canonically in-game she's used it. But it's, like, oscillating with this purple energy as it makes contact, and it explodes. It's not like anything we've seen her do before.
Did she
this
use
point.
Those arrows at the beginning of Legion when they were doing the fight? And
nope.
She said, "Nope,
were,
I'm out of here."
They were black and wispy. They were not like she used in the fight against against Greymane. So they were different at this point.
Okay.
Well, Helya wasn't dead yet, so she wasn't inhabiting Sylvanas' body yet. I mean, what's the problem?
I'm not kidding. I didn't think you were, but to answer the question from my perspective, I think that's when the deal was started, and she might not have known that she was what she was going to get from power wise, just that she was going to get more power, which sweet. So,
yeah, I
want to hear more about Rossi, what Rossi has to say here. So, yeah,
I'm not disagreeing with Joe, just more that I'm going in a slightly different direction with it. I don't think the deal has ever been about power. I think Sylvanas wants escape.
Yeah, but the thing is, what Sophie is asking here is,
yeah, but
why didn't Sylvanas get souped up? Okay, yeah, go for it.
So when she made the deal in the first place, she got the Vrykul, the Valkyr, and she was using them to you know, raise people and create more Forsaken as part of that long-term goal of escape. So when you see Sylvanas fighting Greymane, she has not yet been pushed to the point of desperation because her plans are working. She's got the Valkyr, and she knows that she can get more Valkyr. She's lost a few throughout Cataclysm. So we go into Legion, and she's like, okay, I need a new source because I need the ability. I've just spent like one of, how many Valkyr had to die to fix a Nathanos?
She didn't die.
Okay, but she was drained, right?
What do you mean? How many had to fix Nathanos?
One. And it was one that expended a bunch of power. She's not dead. She's still there.
She got hoovered a little bit, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, she's the one we deal with, with Nathanos on the boat. I'm going to double check. Keep going.
I think so, but yeah.
The point being, she going into Legion, she knows that she can, with enough of these Valkyr at her command, she can create ones like herself and Nathanos. She can, and for all we know, she's used it on herself too, because she seems to be much more, she didn't used to have the ability to explode into Banshee form and then regenerate back up into Sylvanas.
No, not really.
That was also something we never saw her do before.
Mm-hmm.
So you get into Legion and you see, like, you know, everything is working according to plan. She's found Stormheim. She's managed to make contact with Helya. She's gotten the lantern. Everything's coming up Sylvanas. And then suddenly Gen attacks. And keep in mind, up until this point, Gen hated Sylvanas. Sylvanas didn't think much of anything about Gen. She was going to kill him because he was in the way. Oops, she killed his son instead. Whatever. He didn't matter to her. He wasn't a threat.
No.
So she went into that fight, you know, okay, the old dog's here. I'll shoot him and it'll be done. And she does just that. She shoots him. And for at least a second, she thinks he's done. He's on the ground. He's in human form. He's nothing. And only then does she see that he has the lantern. So why didn't she just blast him with the amount of, you know, the power that she used on Sarfang? Well, for one thing, she didn't need to, because she took care of him as far as she knew just fine without it. Two, we don't even know if she had it yet. And the thing is that it makes sense that she wouldn't have it yet, because she wouldn't have felt desperate enough yet. And I think that's all part of the pact from the other side, is getting Sylvanas to feel desperate enough.
Oh yeah, make her go deeper.
And when she loses the lantern, and I think this goes back to war crimes, and I think this goes back to what happened with Garrosh and what happened with Varisa.
Yeah.
When she lost Varisa, that was her first step into real desperation. Because I'm going to say something that I rarely say about Sylvanas Windrunner. She desperately loves her sister.
Oh yeah.
And desperately wanted her back. And would have done anything. She was completely willing to plot, you know, Garrosh's murder. A, she hated Garrosh anyway, so sure, why not murder him? But look at how fast she goes right into the plan. And how quickly, despite having misgivings, she just takes Varisa's ideas. She would have done anything to get Varisa back. And when she didn't, that started to push her. And so she turns Nathanos into what he is now, so she's got something. At least she's got somebody who will do exactly what she says when she says it.
And in her own way, she loves him too, like, even when they're alive.
There is something there.
Yeah.
But when she goes into Legion, she thinks this is all working perfectly. And keep in mind, if would have had you know, Anduin gotten his way, her plan would have worked flawlessly. The reason it didn't work was because Alliance leaders who hate the Horde a lot more than Anduin does were not willing to take his orders. And so they hunted the Forsaken down and attacked them anyway. That's Sky Admiral Rogers and Gen right there. And that's directly defying Anduin when that happens. If not for them doing that, and even then, even when Gen finds her, he is not a threat to her. She shoots him down. She thinks she's won. And only then does she realize that Gen, for all his being a werewolf, he was thinking. And he realized he couldn't hurt her, so he went for the thing that would hurt her.
Yep.
And up until that point, everything was going her way. Why would she be desperate enough yet? But now you break that thing. Now she can't get another Vrykul. She can't get any more Valkyr.
And she's dwindling at this point. Because, I mean, if you go through it, she started with 9.
Mm-hmm.
And two unaccounted for. Right?
One of them died in Anderhal.
So we have Agatha. Yep. Agatha, Anhyde, Aradane, Arthura, Dasla are all dead. And Brynja was killed by Tyrande.
Mm-hmm. But that was before the Tyrande killing one was after this.
But
I believe the moment. I'm totally agreeing with you. I'm just saying, I think the moment that she finally got desperate enough to say, all right, what do you want? Was that moment.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
She lost the lantern. Now she's desperate. And desperate people will start. She even says this to Anduin. I mean, not to Anduin, but about Anduin. She's like, the Boy King thinks he's won, but war is a living thing. It shifts and twists. And, you know, he doesn't know who will be on top when this is all over. She knows how far she'll go to win.
Well, not only that, how far she'll go to survive.
Yes.
And the reason I bring that up is because the first time she died, only one Valkyr exchanged her place for Sylvanas. When we saw it later, when Walden shot her, it took three. She's running out of chances to escape her fate. Like you said, she is further and further going into that desperation mode.
Yeah. And that's the thing. That's, I think, why you don't see her using that power before, because A, she didn't need it. And B, she may not even have had it. And you'll notice that, like, when you go into Battle for Azeroth, when you watch the opening cinematic, the stuff she's doing is stuff she never did before. Mm-hmm. The, you know, not just the blowing up of the siege tower, but the thing where she blasts out into full Banshee mode and, you know, destroys like multiple alliance and then reforms herself. That's new. And the only reason that more people didn't call her on it was the fact that they were just busy in the moment of, you know, alliance versus horde conflict, and nobody had time to go, wait a minute. She can do that? How long has she been able to do that?
And when she does do stuff later, they comment on it. They comment, I have no idea what she's doing. I've never seen this before.
There's just a lot to this that we're like, the idea that, you know, why didn't she do it back then? Because she wasn't desperate enough yet. And that's what makes me think that we're going to hear more about Helya, because I'm pretty sure Helya serves as the gateway drug here.
Oh, yeah.
The whole reason Helya made that deal was because it would push her. Because it would lead to her being, you know, dismayed. That's why Helya doesn't stop you. When you go down into her realm, Helya does not put up much of an effort to stop you. You're going to tell me that one, just because one ex-Valkyr is like, you know, defending you, that Helya is going to let you go?
And not only that, three times. Three yeah. times. Because not only are you in her realm and doing that and defying her in her own realm, her place of power, with all of these souls that she's been collecting for ages at this point, you beat her back from a boat, like going through, you know, a small party of you with one of her most trusted servants before dealing with her. And then the raid, like, also taking place in her place of power. It was all according to her plan. No doubt in my mind about that. I agree.
Okay. Much as this has been fascinating, we've actually eaten up the whole hour that we've had to talk.
Before you do. One thing I want to point out too, the fight Joe was talking about is in the dungeon called Maw of Souls.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
And there's the guy who's running the boat is named Harboron.
He's a celestial.
And he's a celestial like Halgalon.
Yep. Yep.
Possibly he's the dead celestial that Sargeras killed.
It's entirely possible. Okay. So we're going to go ahead and Consular. Yes. We're going to go ahead and wrap things up here. Blizzard Watch. It's made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch, and your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. That's why we have a weekly lore watch, you guys. Blizzard Watch supporters, they enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your question answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for you guys, the listeners of Blizzard Watch, I know we were talking about it a lot today. Audible's offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. The novel Arthas, Rise of the Lich King, is actually one of those books that is available as an audiobook, and you could use your free trial to get that book. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in there. It's about the history of Arthas, but in between there's also bits and pieces about the Lich King, and the end of the book itself is really fascinating in terms of where is Ner'zhul? Where is Arthas? Are they still there? Are they not? We don't know. So you can get that as your free 30-day trial. You could get any of Blizzard's other titles, or, you know, Audible's got thousands and thousands of other books that you could choose from. You could download any of Blizzard's titles, any of those other books, by going to blizzardwatch.com/audible, where every sign up helps support the show and everything that we do. And final thoughts, you guys, I have a doozy for you. If we go back to the first little bit that we were talking about here, and if we say that the Naru are soul engines, what exactly did they do to Kalia Menethil? Rossi.
Stuck some light in there. The thing is that the Naru themselves used Anduin and Alansis to raise her.
Mm-hmm.
So it feels to me like it's possible that they deliberately siphoned a little bit of Anduin's light and Alansis's undead.
Did they just forge a soul?
that's certainly one possibility. But I think it's more along the lines of they kind of borrowed bits from the other two.
I think it's their facsimile of a soul. Like it's going to sound weird, but we talked about this earlier this episode. What is a soul? It's light and shadow. It's both.
Part two of this then. Is Kalia really Kalia?
I'm going to say yes.
I'm hitting you with the hard ones today. I'm sorry.
No. It's complicated, but I think the answer is yes. But I think she is a new thing. She is something that the Naru didn't know could be made yet. And then this is new. This is the first thing, but she's still Kalia as much as, you know, Darien and all the rest are still themselves as well. There might be strings attached, but she's still her in most regard.
I'd agree, because I don't think she'd be useful to them if she wasn't kill Kalia. I think that's the entire point. The Naru want to see how this works. She's a prototype.
Yep.
Anybody, you can just reanimate a corpse as a mindless automaton, easy. We see that all the time. Skeletons, yeah, that's what they are. But to put the animating force back in and keep it active, that's the interesting thing.
I think the next step is going to be they're going to capture or try it on somebody who is forsaken.
Oh, light forged. Oh my God, headache from this idea. The light forged is the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they just took the light forging process and kind of tweaked it.
Light forged 2.0. Because if you look at her, like even her model, it's not swirling with light and fell. She's definitely glowing light. Like she looks closer to a light forge than she does a forsaken.
Okay. Well, that's going to go ahead and wrap us up for the show. Thanks, you guys, as always, for listening, and we will see you again next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.